Welcome to everyone joining us here tonight on the Kings County Radio Club's Technical Question and Answer Net. My name is Roy, my call sign is AC2GS, and I will be your net control operator for this informal net. I will be your host, and Bob, KD2NVB, will be my co-host on this exploration into amateur radio technology. The purpose of this net is to provide a platform for discussion and to offer our answers, as well as promote a conversation among all participants of this net. The club maintains an archive of these technical nets on its webpage. And we also offer original articles and reviews on many topics covered during these technical nets. We will be offering a streaming service for those who cannot receive our repeater signal. Just point your browser to stream.kc2rc.com. We also have an Echo Link node available for use. Just point your Echo Link application to the node kc2rc-r. This net is scheduled for the second and fourth Wednesday of every month. All of this information could also be found on our club's website, which is www.kc2rc.com. Members as well as non-members are welcome to participate, although we do appreciate it when our fellow hams join our club, and as always, an application is readily available on our club's website. No question is too simple, no question is dumb. All wisdom begins with the asking of questions. If you have a question, it deserves to be answered. Our format tonight will be to ask for participants to check in only if they have questions or comments for this net. Please give us your first name, your call sign, whether you have a question or a comment. The net will then address each question in order. I will try to provide a cogent answer, and Bob, KD2NVB, will join in as well. If any other listener has any further facts or opinions, they will be free to break in with the word comment, and when recognized, offer their knowledge or experiences to us all. If anyone has any suggestions for future topics of interest here, please let us know either here on the net or use our email address, which is tech@kc2rc.com. And now I would like to introduce my co-host for this net, Bob, KD2NVB. Good evening, Bob.
Hi, good evening, everybody out there. Looking forward to a good net tonight. Back to you, Roy.
Okay, very good, Bob. I hope you had a great Thanksgiving. I'm not incredibly optimistic about tonight because last time I did this with William, basically I talked to William and William talked to me, and there was absolutely no other people on the net. So not thinking that this particular one is going to be that much more populous. I will comment to you, because I'm not sure if there's anyone else listening. We're going to kind of cancel the next one, which is going to be, I think, Christmas Eve, because if there's no one now, you can imagine how few people will be around for Christmas Eve. So put it in your calendar that our next scheduled technical net will be January 14th. Hopefully the new year will bring us more activity. Anyway, I am AC2GS, and this is the Kings County Radio Club Technical Net. Anyone out there is listening to me and has a question or a comment or a topic for discussion, please feel free to hit that push to talk and ID yourself.
MVP, doesn't look too good out there. Yeah, I'm just as happy you canceled. I figured you'd cancel Christmas Eve. I'll be out of town anyway. And, of course, the last one was Thanksgiving Eve. It might have been an influence on all the lack of attendance as well. Back to you and maybe somebody out there.
Maybe. I don't know. Thanksgiving Eve, I could understand people, making the food and such. Most of the guys who occasionally show up on the net don't strike me as chefs. But you never know. It was a pleasant conversation between me and William, but, you know, I could have had it on a phone call. Anyway, once again, I am still AC2GS, and I'm still waiting for a question or a topic or a comment or something to chat about, technologically speaking. So if anyone out there has anything, any questions or comments or topics, feel free to hit that push to talk and ID yourselves. Well, I don't know. This doesn't strike me as a good beginning for our net tonight. I think it's going to be a rather short one. We'll give people an opportunity to show up a little late, but, you know, not too late. I mean, at one point, I sat around here by myself until about 9:15 or 9:17, and then I just kind of called it a night, and someone told me a week or two later that they came by at 9:30, but, you know, to to drag out silence for a half hour doesn't strike me as a good use for anyone's time. So we'll give people another 7 minutes, give or take. And if we don't get any activity, we'll meet again in January.
Roger, sounds good. So to roughly 9:15 or so, I guess.
Yeah, I think that's a reasonable amount of time to give people for a net. I've never really kind of investigated how long people give people. Well, William appears to have popped up on the Echo Link, so maybe William will check in and have a question or a comment for tonight.
Hey, Roy. Just checking in. I'm going to say good evening. I don't know if anybody else is online or not, but maybe Bob is. And hello to you guys. Happy holidays. What's going on?
William, we're here. This is Bob, KD2NVB. Yeah, we're just waiting for some people, I guess, and you're here. So I don't know if you have any questions or anything. Back to you, back to the net.
Okay, I'll try again. I think Bob didn't hear me or something. Happy, healthy New Year and Merry Christmas, William. We're, you know, if we don't get any kind of net activity, we're going to kind of call it an early net, but we'll see how things go.
Okay, Roy, the other night I heard your announcement about whatever your normal shield was on the Limart TechNet on Sunday night. Did a check-in with the ARES, and I also somehow got you too. Filling with the radio, but you said something about having a website at something or other .tv. I tried that and it got blocked because of pornography, so I don't think I got that right. So I was hoping you could tell me, what was that website that you had with a lot of ham radio information on it?
Yeah, it's you type in amateurradio.tv. It's not a foreign site. It's an archive of nets that have come and gone. The only one remaining that's still active is the Limart technical net, and the gentleman there, Mike, has been archiving that net since September of 2006.
Whoops, sorry, I dropped off because I tapped the phone wrong. Didn't hear your last reply, Roy. I'm going to go back to the radio now.
Okay, hopefully, William, you're at the radio. It's an archive site of nets. Most of them have terminated activity because, unfortunately, that's the trend. It's the name of the site is amateurradio.tv. It's not a porn site. If you type it correctly, I think you have to do both words. You can't kind of use the same, the end R for the beginning R of radio. So amateurradio.tv, and it has archives going back all the way to 2006.
It's working for me now. Thank you so much, Roy. I didn't realize that this was out there.
Yep, like I said, it's been out at least since 2006. When Dick ran the Limart technical net, he has his recordings available there. And when I took it over, mine are there. And if you check very closely, you could actually even find my debut episode where I'm introduced as the guy who's supposed to give Dick mailbag questions. Those were email questions that people would send in to Dick, and it would be my job that I took over to read them, and Dick would answer them. Unfortunately, no one sent any emails, and Dick decided that he needed to pick someone up from the airport. So he basically just handed me the keys, and he said, you know, keep it alive for a couple hours. And I basically just vamped. I did my favorite subject, science, because I wasn't going to do Dick's thing, because Dick did that thing. So I had to figure out something else to do on a technical net, and so I did a off the top of my head discussion of science as Dick drove with the radio on to the airport.
Sounds like fun. I see there's a fractal antenna on here. What's a fractal antenna?
Well, you know, I mean, if you've ever seen those fractals, they do a lot of Mandelbrot and other such. It's self-replicating patterns of the radiating elements. Rather than them being a straight element, they're bent in a repeating pattern until they reach infinitesimal. And in real mathematics, it never ends. If you zoom into a fractal, you just get a fractal again. The smaller you zoom into, the more detail that you see the same fractal is continuing. It's an interesting little thing. There's not that many antennas that do that. They're usually for very compact antennas, you know, where you don't have a lot of area, but you want to have it mechanically resonant, so you bend it in and around itself so that you contain a much longer length in a much smaller area.
Well, I see those log periodic antennas that have lots of smaller elements out to the front, but that's not what you're talking about, is it?
Those are multi-array antennas. This is where the element needs to be relatively long, but the area that you're going to encase it in has to be rather small. So you basically are crisscrossing and compacting down a single element into a really strange shape. But it's a single element. It's not a multi-element.
That sounds really interesting. I'm going to go look that up and find out some more. I don't really have much technical questions here tonight. Bob, how was your trip to D.C.? Did you have a nice trip?
Actually, I didn't go to D.C. I went to my aunt's, which is in by UConn, meaning University of Connecticut, like about 30 miles east of Hartford, like Storrs, Mansfield area of Connecticut. It was very nice. Yeah, they're both over 90. They still have their own house. I mean, their uncle's having some issues right now, but it was very nice. It was very nice. Cousins also is a little branch of the family that I really like and been going up there for years. Back to you.
I think that's a much nicer drive than driving to D.C. I think Connecticut is a lot nicer than D.C. in a lot of ways. Great to hear you had a nice family vacation, and I was happy to chat with Roy, but we didn't have much participation the other night either.
Just the two of you.
Sort of like tonight. Can't raise anybody that's interested in ham radio.
Hey, let's see if anyone's out there by any small chance.
Quick question for Roy. You know, recently I had a problem with one of my power supplies, and it was dead. And I looked at the power supply, and it had a code on it. It didn't really say what it was, but it was a cell phone power supply. And then I found out that it had a whole series of power supplies that was called the PD3.0 protocol. And I guess it's been out there for a while. I was wondering, Roy, if that power supply seems to be able to put out multiple voltages, depending on who's talking to it, up to 12 volts. And I think that damaged some equipment. So I'm just wondering if you know much about that PD3 spec and those power supplies that are supposed to provide fast charging and how it doesn't blow out the batteries by giving them 12 volts. I thought that was really interesting, but I couldn't find much when I started looking into it.
Okay, AC2GS, by the way. That's a USB-C or 3.1 protocol that it holds the device. Theoretically, if both the power supply and the cable and the device is able to work with PD protocols, power device protocols, it will pull the power supply for the voltage that it requires, and then hopefully the power supply will supply that voltage and that current, which the device is capable of dealing with and using to fast charge. There are some unfortunate cases. If you buy very cheap devices that are somehow vaguely hooked up to a USB-C connector, it doesn't necessarily work correctly. I had one of those little plasma globes, those little 2-inch diameter desktop globes that you could plug in a USB adapter to the power input, and it supercharged it for about 30 seconds and then burnt out because, unfortunately, the cable and the power supply gave it more voltage than the 5 volts that it was spec'd at. So it's certainly possible to screw things up. When everything is working the right way, though, it makes it capable. The same USB-C power source can run your laptop because it will send the signal to Boosie voltage to 12 volts and the current to a very high current enough to actually charge a laptop's a battery. Whereas, you know, if you just fed it 5 volts at 1 watt or 1 amp, you know, it would take forever if it ever did anything. Probably wouldn't charge at all at 5 volts. But that's what PD is. It's a power device protocol.
Do you think that there's anything special about this cable? Like there's a chip built into the cable or something like that that also has something to do with it? Because it seems like that's very easy to sneak into cables these days. And they always say something about the cable as well as the power supply.
Well, yeah, I mentioned just a moment ago that it's a process that involves both the power supply, the cable, and the device that's using the power. Yeah, these USB cables have little chips in the heads. That's why every so often I'll read an article where it tells people to never use extension cords. USB-C extension cords are kind of a no-no. You can get away with it, but sometimes because they're not really designed to handshake the way that a simple cable with, you know, two males on either side, you can damage something. So it's a probably good practice to be very wary of using additional extension length cords where you have a male C connector and a female C connector.
That's really interesting with the power supplies and all that stuff. So even if I have one of these connectors, proper power supplies, and I use the wrong cable, will the protocol just not transmit up to the, maybe it uses an extra pin for that communications path through the USB cable? I'm not sure what that would be, why they would need a special cable.
Well, because the specs change. You know, you could buy a USB-C cable, but it doesn't necessarily have the power handling capacity you want, nor might it have the signal rate that you might. If you always just, you know, feed it to the devices that want 5 volts and that have a very low bit symbol rate, you won't have any problems. But I've had a lot of times where you got to look around for the right USB connector. Recently, manufacturers have actually been putting information like that on the head of the connectors. But up until recently, they were pretty much unlabeled, except that occasionally you would get high-quality USB cables that were Lightning certified, that had higher symbol rate transfers, and you'd be able to recognize the Lightning bolt on it. But a lot of times, they never used to label anything. So you just kind of got a collection of USB cables and you tried one after the other, after the other, after the other, until you got something that gave you satisfactory transfer rates.
That chip is talking about a lot of things, like what it's certified for in terms of current and transfer rate. I could see that a thinner cable might blow out if you tried to run too much current through it, even if the device said, yeah, I can accept it. So that, I guess that's a protection method to keep the cables from burning out. If you don't use the right cable, it probably doesn't work.
Yeah. I mean, I've kind of never tried that. I always go to the point, if I don't know of a device that has a USB cable that I'm already using, I'll get it specifically from Amazon and make sure the specs are right. But yeah, it's problematic. They've been putting little chips into connectors since Apple's days with their Lightning technology. All those Lightning connectors had little chips put in their heads that unfortunately the generic versions would stop working after a certain amount of time for who knows what reason. But they've been putting chips in it. It's also, in the case of Apple, an anti-piracy type of situation. But they power a lot of different things in Lightning chips, even though because of the European Union, they had to go off of the Lightning chips because they were proprietary and move on to USB-C or micro USB connectors.
Yeah, well, this particular device used a micro USB connector, and I thought I was going to be really smart, and I got a switch that would be able to switch the thing on and off, because this thing didn't have an on-off switch, and I wanted to be able to turn it off. So I thought, oh, I'll just get this USB switch off the internet. And I got the switch, and the switch wouldn't work. Nothing worked when I plugged the switch in. There was no on. It just always was off. So maybe the switch wasn't letting that data pass, or maybe that was enough of a block that it decided it wasn't going to put out any voltage at all because the switch was there. It didn't see its cable.
Did the switch work with other USB cables?
Well, I didn't really have other reasons to use that switch. I think I've lost track of where that switch went. So I plugged the original cable in, it worked fine. And then just recently, the power supply died, and that's when I found out about all this stuff. This one is 20 watts, and then I found out that they also have options to go 30 or even 48 watts, much higher powers from these power supplies, and then they start costing, you know, a lot of money, like $25 rather than two for 10.
Yeah, well, you gotta understand what kind of use you're going to put them to. Like I said before, there are people who plug those. Nowadays, the technology for these wool warts is amazing. They're able to give over 100 watts in a relatively small package. So you're able to, there are some plugs that will supply USB power to charge up a laptop, like I said. You need a significantly more than 40 watts to do that. So they've been kind of upscaling the possible powers that it outputs depending upon the handshake algorithm with a smart chip in the device that's taking the charge.
Really, there's no way to identify whether or not these cables are good for one thing or another. You just sort of have to have your bag of tricks and try them out and see what works. I guess that's what happens.
Yeah, that's about it. Like I said, nowadays, thankfully, they're doing a better job of labeling. So that's less of a problem. But still, you know, if you're not quite used to what your connector is capable of, it's probably more cost effective to just buy a brand new one from Amazon that's specced for the proper powers and the transfer rate. Again, because different devices you might need, you might want for some reason to use a powerful charger to charge up a laptop or something, 50 watts. And so, if you have a USB cable that's already doing that, you kind of, you don't have to take too many chances. But in other cases, you don't really want a lot of power. You just want a very fast transfer. It's, you're feeding a high resolution video camera to your computer. So you need the fastest stream that you could make, and you're not that concerned with how many watts of power can go through it. So it requires different designs. You can combine both of them sometimes, but their thick wires will make for more current flow, but not necessarily a faster bit rate for the data. You have to, you got to make very careful that there's no interference from one pin to another. So you can go at high speeds without having interference between the signal pins.
It's very interesting. I mean, from like doing a little basic like head pounding against the wall with this, I found out that this 20 watt power supply is able to do 5 volts at 3 amps or 12 volts, whatever, and it does as the volts go up, the amperage goes down, so it still stays within that 20 watt footprint. But then the later spec I found out is able to adjust the voltage in the millivolts, depending on what the device wants, and then that's a whole discussion about, how the device is able to communicate how many millivolts more or less voltage. But like back dumb me, I thought USB was always 5 volts, and I think now it must be up to 12 volts or even higher. How high can USB go?
As far as I know, 48 volts is the top power right now, but I'm sure that's subject to change. Way back at the very beginning, it started, as you mentioned, as 5 volts, and usually it was 5 to 10 watts, way back when, but every few years they iterate new extended power ranges.
Yeah, I know, because my go-to power supply was a 10-watt, 5-volt power supply that seemed to work on everything, but it certainly didn't look like it was going to work on this device with a 20-watt requirement. So, and I'm just totally surprised that this happened, and I had my head someplace in the dark spot, and I didn't even notice that what was going on, and I just kept, everything is 5 volts, and I just wondered how the higher speed charging worked, and now I understand a little bit better the higher voltage. I guess they have better power handling capabilities, and the batteries must be higher voltage than 5 volts, and they must have been using step-up things in those devices that wanted 12 volts to make it work on 5 and stuff like that. So anyway, it's all new world to me, and I guess that's why continuous education is so important.
Yep, if you sleep too late, you miss a new invention. So far as I'm aware, the most power you can shove down one of these things is 240 watts. That would be 48 volts at 5 amps.
Amps on a 10-foot cable will probably mean it's like 24 or 22 gauge, maybe even 20 gauge. I don't know. It seems like it'd be a pretty hefty cable after a while.
It's only 5 amps. It's a current that has the most effect on these things. So, you know, they're thicker, but they're not terribly thick. I mean, I'm sure you've kind of seen what kind of wires feed laptop power supplies. They're not excessively thick.
But the pins and the connectors are pretty tiny. On a deconnector, when I was doing engineering and building equipment and stuff, all we could put through one pin on a DB25 connector was 1 amp. Didn't matter what voltage, but you only get 1 amp through a pin on a 25-pin D connector, which is the same pin as a 9-pin D connector. And but these little connectors inside the USB, connector look smaller than the D pins. I think D pin was round and it had a lot of surface area. These little dinky little contacts inside the USB connector aren't much at all. And it's interesting they can get 5 amps through that. It's just amazing what engineering will do these days.
Yeah. Most of the times they get it right. Every so often, not too right. There was a problem a few years ago with one of the relatively later, greater graphics boards that were requiring 500 watts of power plus. And they had a special pin, and they had a new configuration of a power supply, and the connector wasn't quite ready for prime time, and people were getting short circuits and burns, and all messes. The connector was just burning up because it didn't fully contact, and it wasn't capable of dissipating the current that the high power graphics cards were requiring back then.
That could be a huge problem for all the manufacturers having to put warranties, because that would probably burn out really quickly. It'd be within your 30-day warranty, you'd have a problem. This is AC2ZV, by the way.
Yeah, the industry took a hit, and there was a lot of finger-pointing at each other, but it's quieted down since then, so I guess they solved that problem.
Let's see if we attracted anybody else to listen to the TechNet and have a question for you, Roy. It's after 9:30, so maybe somebody else has joined us.
Okay, I'll give it another try. This is Alpha Charlie 2 Golf Sierra AC2GS. My name is Roy. I'm net control operator for this, the Kings County Radio Club Technical Net. We're here usually on the second and fourth Wednesday of the month at 9 p.m. And if anyone out there hears us and has a question of a technical nature or wants to discuss a technical subject, we just got finished talking about power data protocols of USB devices. If anyone out there has any other questions or comments, please hit that push to talk and ID yourselves.
G2RY.
Hello, David. How are you this fine night?
Complaints. A nice night. Weather's cold, but the air is very clean.
Well, that's good to hear. It isn't like earlier in the fall when those fires up in Canada were billowing smoke all over the area.
The smoke had a smell, I remember. And if you look around, there is like yellow haze everywhere.
Yeah, I don't know exactly what variety of tree primarily was burning up there. Maybe that's a part of the thing that kind of tainted the smoke.
The kettle start with a cigarette butt.
I never quite heard what was the cause of the Canadian fire. I know they found the guy in California who set the fire there.
The dryness in the air doesn't help either. You know, it's the leaves and the tree, the actual tree, how to say, if there's a minimal of moisture there, you know, that it's easy, you know, easier for it to inflame.
Yeah, but ultimately there's some kind of site of ignition. Forests don't spontaneously ignite. You know, I mean, there might be a man-made cause, or there might be a natural cause, a lightning strike or what have you, might trigger a forest fire. I think, unfortunately, a lot of times it's human beings that are triggering them these days.
I realize that any fire, forest fire, any fire, you know, there would be no reason at all to set the fire, you know, to create that fire. But I don't understand. Some people, you know, maybe they have a different way to think.
If you ever saw the recent Batman trilogy, there's a great line where Batman's butler turns to Bruce Wayne and he says, some people just want to see the world burn down.
QSL. And, how to say, it's easier, I guess, to receive negative treatment from people. It's easier, maybe it's harder to receive a bad treatment, and it's easier to give.
I don't know. I find, unfortunately, it's far easier to destroy than to build something.
You know, a person can pay to receive. A lot of times, that's what people do. They pay, and they get a good or some service or whatever, the products, and they pay to receive. But what would happen if a person has the ability to give and receive at the exact same time?
Well, I guess that was theoretically the concept for barter, which I understand wasn't actually the first economic system. It was more of an incidental thing, but that's a bit what barter tends to be in its simplest form. I'll give you two sheeps for a dozen chickens or what have you.
The idea of giving and receiving at the same time, you know, doing that, it is like a person can achieve some higher state of consciousness. And, you know, I think that this kind of interaction, you know, is, it's like playing an instrument, like performing in front of a lot of people.
I guess it depends on the individuals involved. I mean, at its very simplest, it's just a form of trade. You know, you give someone something and he gives you something in exchange. Both of you think that the value of the thing that you got is worth more than the thing that you gave. Otherwise, you wouldn't trade it. And it's just, an aspect of economics. I don't know if it raises you to a higher level of being. It might feed you for the night. Again, depending upon what it is you're trading for.
Give the sound, and you make the sound with the instrument, or with the voice, or with whatever. You make the sound, but you're also hearing the sound and the energy of the people in the audience.
Okay, but that's a kind of a very, very specific niche type of exchange. I'm sure people exchanged goods that improved their survival, food, shelter, what have you, versus music. I think a lot of times music was kind of, the musicians played, and if the patrons enjoyed it, then they gave them, you know, money in return or something similar to that, and unfortunately, if they didn't like their playing and they weren't in good spirits, they walked on in the street.
That's pay to receive. Pay to receive. You pay money for something. Pay for inspiration. Pay for wisdom. You pay for sound of music. You know, you pay and you receive. But But I'm talking about giving and receiving at the same time.
Okay. I don't know where music comes into that, because usually you're either giving applause, or you're giving money, or you're giving something of value. So, I don't know. Six of one, half a dozen of the other.
Let's say you're in a foreign country. Let's say you're in a country in Europe. You're staying at an ashram, and there's 1,200 people sitting there listening to you play some devotional music. The leader of the group is dead, and you're playing, and you're also listening, and everybody else is listening and interacting. And for me, that was like bigger than life.
Okay, that's not the usual way performances run. They're a lot more often passive. But yeah, I guess so, if it's a communal experience as opposed to a performance.
Well, you know, it was a big experience. You know, that particular one, there were other ones, but that one specifically, because I was in a place, you know, I never even expected to be there. And I played the notes, I played the chords, I played the sounds, and sang the Sanskrit words, and somehow it was big. Maybe it was because I had a really good sounding guitar. Maybe I played just okay.
Yeah, you never know. Sometimes the experience can add a great deal to the to everything. So, you know, unless you have a recording of it and you play it back when you're home and you listen and you say, gee, that was fantastic, versus, okay, that's the average way I sound. So, yeah, it's kind of difficult to extract the just the performance from the experience in most cases.
No. Now that you say about the recording, you know, after I stay in this place, you know, for another week, I played for a week, I stayed for another week, maybe a little bit longer, and I watched all the tapes of the guru. I watched all the tapes, and I got so tired of it. I went to Paris. I met this woman on the bridge. And we dated for a few, maybe four or five days. And then, I went home and I wrote a song for her on the telephone while she was listening.
Yeah, that sounds romantic.
Took me around to all these places in Paris where I could play. But, you know, what a great time that was. And, I didn't want to be with her permanently, but... You know, at least I know that the recording still exists, you know. And I wrote the song while I was making the recording, which I played over the telephone, which she could hear.
Okay.
I have a question to ask you about technology.
Okay.
To RY. Yeah, I have this old-style flip phone by a company called Sonim. It has a mega-sized battery in it, FM broadcast, MP3 player, and it's great for talking really long periods of time. You can talk on it for hours.
Okay.
You ever talk on your iPhone at night with a friend and you're afraid that the battery drain is going to be excessive?
No, I'm a little bit obsessive about power. You know, I charge my cell phone every chance I can get, and I have extra power supplies that kind of stick on the back and supply auxiliary power. So I usually don't worry too much about running out of power.
What if the phone is in your pocket, or you're not near a place where you can charge it? My iPhone works pretty good, and I can't play so much music on it, maybe 3 hours or so, and talking is a battery drain, but it's not terrible, but I can't listen to music on it.
Okay, well, it sort of also depends upon what your output device is. Some listening devices are very low power draw, you know, wired earphones and such. So that, you know, it depends on a lot of factors. But I haven't had that problem because I've been perpetually kind of looking around for solutions of not running out of power. So like I said, I have those add-on, you know, magnetic devices. They stick on the back of my iPhone, and they supply extra power if I'm running low. So, you know, if I have one or two of those in my pocket, yeah, there's little chance of me running the battery down on the thing.
Yeah, I have a couple of those. My iPhone, the battery is 1137 milliamp hours. The screen is like 6.1 inches diagonal. And the Sonim, the battery is 2300 milliamp hours, and the screen is like 2.8 inches. And battery, you know, you can go standby with the Sonim for about 4 or 5 days, maybe more. And you can talk on it for about 40 hours. That's the rating that they give to it.
Okay, well, but it ultimately, like most things in life, it's a compromise. There are a lot more things that I could probably do with my cell phone that you can't do with your Sonim, simply because it doesn't have that computational power and display capability. So, you know, six of one, half a dozen of the others. If the most important thing is basic use, and you can't find yourself near to a recharging base for a long time, then your Sonim is a good choice. If you are practically almost always next to a recharge capability and you have extra batteries and you really like to run all those state-of-the-art applications, then an iPhone would probably be the preferable choice under those circumstances.
So, yeah, I forgot what I wanted to say. It was about... what is that about? I don't remember. But anyway, it's good if you're going camping and you got like 4 days or 5 days and, you know, you bring a charger but there's nowhere to plug it in and, you know, you want to talk to your friend for a few hours while you're up on the site. And what else? Military grade construction. And the Sonim XP3 Plus, take a screwdriver, you can unscrew the back, take the back off, and put another battery in there.
Yes, yes, that's a good feature. I thought that the European Union was going to force Apple to do that, but it hasn't been able to do that yet. And I, generally speaking, don't go camping, so that's not a situation that I need to solve. And, you know, it would be nice to have a replaceable battery, but what can you do?
I talked to Apple, I don't remember, it must have been at least a few years ago. I asked them, why is the back glued on, you can't take it off. They said the reason why they do that is because of moisture, you know, that it protects the insides of the phone from moisture.
They're clever people. I'm sure they could figure another waterproofing method like a gasket and some little screws. They just don't want people to be able to do that because it'll decrease the amount of sales for new cell phones or at the very least mailing your phone or taking your phone into an Apple store and paying $80-$90 to have them swap out the batteries.
B2RY. Well, you know, I'm in the process of getting my Sonim phone unlocked in case I want to travel. I can just put in a nano SIM.
Yeah, once you unlock it, you are free to be able to do that. And there's a whole bunch of different companies that offer something similar to use with an unlocked cell phone.
One is a little bit complicated, and I have to do it through my mobile carrier. You know, mobile carrier, talk and text, $20 a month.
Okay, well, you got to do it through your provider, because your provider is the people that locked it. So they're the only one that can unlock it.
Well, you have to wait about a month or so before I can request to unlock the phone.
Okay, the different providers have different methods to get it. It depends upon the contract that they had you sign.
The device itself, you know, has certain, things that you have to do to unlock the phone.
Yeah, there's digits, there's codes, and the provider has to transmit some codes through the cell tower to unlock them.
Well, yeah, I know about that. I have to put a code in there once I put the foreign SIM in it, so that would probably work okay, and, in about a month, I'm going to make sure that this has taken place in my phone.
Okay, a lot of people have done it before, and a lot of people will do it after you. It's an incredibly common thing. It's obviously providers, need contracts to kind of pay for the hardware that they give you a discount, and so they lock it so that you're stuck with them until a certain time, and then as per whatever contract says, they can unlock it for you, and you can take your hardware to any provider, plug in some kind of something that works as a SIM card and use the other service as long as the protocols are the same.
The foreign roaming.
It's still the same protocols. It's just that you have the ability to go to other providers with those protocols out of state.
They want me to stay with them.
They want you to continue being a customer and giving them more of a profit.
But, when I return back home, I can reinstate my service.
Yeah, you don't have to particularly lock that, but you can get a SIM card or an artificial, digital SIM card from your provider and use that in the United States. They get a profit. You get to use their services, but if you want to go someplace else, you can pop a SIM card out, put another one in, and use someone else's services.
Phone, you unscrew the back, take the back off, take the battery out, and then there's a cage for the SIM card, and there's a cage for the micro SD card. The cage for the SIM card, that's the one you would replace. I guess I would leave the micro SD card in there.
Yeah, that stores pictures or MP3s or what have you. You just need to do the SIM card. In the old days, iPhones had this little thing. You pushed a teeny tiny button and a slot opened up and you could slide a SIM card into it. I think nowadays they favor digital SIM cards that don't have a physical existence.
I don't remember.
Yeah, I haven't had one of the recent models, but I don't think that they have slots anymore.
Yes, I know. And the Sonim phone is water-resistant. I don't know if it's waterproof, but it would be about as waterproof as an iPhone, maybe more.
Okay, it sort of depends, because there's all kinds of moisture resistance ratings, IPs, IP38, IP52. So it sort of depends, and not all cell phones have the same rating of water resistance.
So I see this phone like an RF device. You can talk on it, and you can talk on it for a long time. And how to say, the service, it's like a radio,
Okay, there's all kinds of different things that you could do. In the old days, iPhone had chips that were able of decoding, receiving and decoding FM radio, but Steve Jobs refused to implement it in the software. So iPhones were never able to pick up FM radio signals.
XP3 Plus has capability to receive FM broadcast in stereo.
Yeah, that's not at all unusual. Like I said before, the chipsets even for the iPhone were capable of that. It just Steve Jobs decided he didn't want it implemented in the software. So it was an unused feature of the chipset.
He wanted to sell this product of Apple Music.
Say again?
Listen to the radio. I think radio is great. And I hear a lot of new music I never heard before on there.
Okay, different strokes for different folks. I find that music these days tends to be rather generic, like it came out of a meat grinding machine. But, you know, everyone to their own. David, it's been loads of fun. It's past 10 o'clock, and I have a couple of things I'd like to do before I get to sleep. So I thank you very much for participating in our technical net tonight.
Thank you very much, Dr. Roy. Have a fantastic night, and see you again soon at TechNet.
Thank you, David. I'm sure I'll talk to you down the road. This is AC2GS, and I will be temporarily clear pending our little end piece that I always say on a technical net. Okay, this net has been brought to you by the Kings County Radio Club. Our club is an ARRL-affiliated club based in Brooklyn, New York, and we meet on the first Wednesday of each month. Our next meeting will be January 7th, which will be a hybrid meeting. It's a virtual meeting using Zoom software, and the club members will be emailed with the details of the link to that aspect of the meeting. The physical location of the in-person meeting is the Knights of Columbus, located at 1511 10th Avenue. Non-members wishing to join the general club meeting can email me, AC2GS, with some form of identification for the required link. Although our meetings informally begin after 7 p.m., our formal regular general meeting starts at 8 p.m. and continues anywhere from 9 to 9:30, depending upon the number of points that are covered. We have a weekly two-meter club net every Tuesday night at 9 p.m. on this repeater. This technical net meets on the second and fourth Wednesdays of each month at 9 p.m. We also sponsor a 10-meter net every Sunday morning at 11 a.m. on 28.380 upper sideband. We offer an audio stream of our KC2RC repeater on the internet as well as our 10-meter net. Just type into your browser stream.kc2rc.com. Members as well as non-members are welcome to participate, although we do, once again, appreciate it when our fellow hams join our club, and as always, an application is readily available on our club's website. If you would like to contact a host of this technical net, simply address your email to tech@kc2rc.com. We maintain an active website at www.kingscountyradioclub.com or www.kc2rc.com, which offers archives of this technical net, amateur radio news, original articles, and technical forums. Please visit our website and participate. Our website hosting services were generously donated by the local Brooklyn-based web hosting company Three Aliens Web Hosting, who we would like to thank. As the great philosopher Jimi Hendrix once said, knowledge speaks but wisdom listens, so try to listen more and talk less. It's time to roll this all up and shut it all down, but we'll be back to do this again January 14th, and you're all welcome to join us. Thanks to all the people that participated tonight, especially my co-host Bob, KD2NVB. Without you guys, I'd just be talking to myself. So, this is Roy, AC2GS, going clear and getting the heck out of here. Everyone, have a happy, healthy New Year. Have a Merry Christmas. Have a Happy Hanukkah. Take care of yourself, and we'll talk down the line. This is AC2GS Clear.
AC2NVB going clear. Wishing everybody happy holiday season. See you back in January on this net.